I got a
Welsh prime ministers then.
Sorry?
Is there any Welsh prime ministers?
Lloyd George.
Lloyd George was from Manchester. His parents were Welsh.
Yeah, he always said he was Welsh. That's
I mean, if the alternative is admitting you're from Manchester. Mind you.
Wait, are you moving to Liverpool? No, sorry, I think you're moving. Are you moving to Manchester?
No, no, I'm moving to Liverpool.
Oh, that's so much difference.
No, so like they're now officially my enemy, so I've got to make fun of people from Manchester. I think that's how it works.
Yeah.
I'm trying to work out the relevant sectarianism that I'm supposed to be manifesting right now.
So does that
basically
mean
Liverpool is a good one because it's the left one?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Like, if you're Mancunian, does that mean you have to like the Smiths and you have to like Oasis?
Oh, Jesus, could you imagine?
Yeah. That means you have to hate the Beatles. Well, they were from Liverpool. You have to hate the Beatles and you have to like Oasis.
You have to hate
like, no, I'm going to Liverpool, though, so it's the opposite for me.
Mm. It's still pretty bad. Yeah. Well, more what they've become, the two who are still alive. Why does the good one have to die?
Yeah, I mean, I really wish I liked the Beatles because so many of my friends whom I respect enormously really enjoy them, but I just really can't get into them.
Even like 66 on, 65, 66 on?
Yeah, I mean, the only song I can listen to by the Beatles is that one, what's it called? Come Together. I think that's all right.
Really? Come Together?
Yeah, but the rest of them I just can't. I think they're trash, but like, well, that's unfair. I just like, I've tried my best to like the Beatles. I cannot like the Beatles. Same as the Smiths. I just can't like the Smiths either. And like Morrissey's pretty awful from what I gather, right?
That's fighting talk with James. James is pretty much, was anyway, when we lived together, the biggest Smiths fan outside of all the other people who were in their early 20s.
I'm not the biggest Smiths fan, but
you were. Morrissey. Every time that James went out, he put on Charming Man to get dressed too. I remember very clearly. I don't pretend.
Well, that and Correspondence as well.
There's that.
What was the song Morrissey released that was on that FIFA game? It was called something like Irish Blood, English Heart.
Yep, that was it.
And it's just like,
yeah.
I'm working on a Van Dyke. Yeah, I think it's Van Dyke. You know the one with the mustache and the separate goatee.
Oh yeah, yeah. Beautiful.
Yeah, because it's just like because you know I don't have to work right now, so fuck you all. I'm like, why not experiment with facial hair? You
know? Why not?
I'm wearing a hat in what would you say in solidarity with Brendan O'Neill.
Oh god.
Cause
you don't have a giant forehead yet.
Yeah, well because he started wearing hats and streams and stuff.
So, why has Brendan O'Neill started doing this?
Oh, because there's been a campaign where we basically every time you post something, we've been doing these like giant forehead.
Oh no.
Five head.
So yeah, now he's taken to wearing hats.
Oh, lovely. So welcome to this week's anime podcast. This week we have myself, Alex, James, otherwise known as Scottish Bums, can't say that. And Will, who is not a cop, but actually a member of MI5. Not a cop, but actually much, much worse. So this week we're going to be discussing a number of things which are interconnected. Not so much the fallout as the continuing kind of demonstrations, activism connected with the Black Lives Matter, which is now spread across the Atlantic in a positive way, but also what's going on in the States, how in Seattle, the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone, which is now known as the Capitol Hill Occupied Precinct or Occupied Protest, has appeared, as well as the tearing down of statues from everywhere from the West Coast of America all the way over to Indonesia now, someone that far, believe it or not, and obviously Australia as well. So there's lots to discuss. We probably will begin with a basic kind of what's going on at the moment as I get my phone. So basically, how have the Black Lives Matters protests evolved since the last we discussed them about 2 weeks ago? Well, the protests are ongoing. There's less looting now going on for a variety of reasons, both because the demonstrators themselves increasingly told those who were arriving just to kick, break shit and cause problems to stop. The police apparently were told as well to stop sending in as many agents provocateurs, by who, you can use your imagination. The police, especially in New York, but a number of other places, have done sob stories like, oh, you're treating us so badly, we're lovely, we just crack people's heads and strangle people. So there's a continuing debate. Trump has agreed to a law banning chokeholds, though, again, that's not necessarily going to A, pass, or B, even be enforced if it is passed. Places like Seattle, police officers have been pulled back. We'll be talking about that in a second, how areas have become autonomous or kind of self-governing because police have withdrawn. It has spread to other countries. In England, statue of Edward Colston, I think it's pronounced his name, was torn down and thrown into the sea in Bristol. In Brussels, I think, or certainly in Belgium anyway, statue of mass murderer King Leopold II, who personally ran the Congo colony and maybe killed upwards of 10 to 15 million people, given his tactics in the 1880s through to the early part of the 20th century, has been torn down. A number of statues there in Australia, demands for James Cook to be torn down. The list really goes on and on. It's become it's spread around the world, dealing with old colonials' wounds or old racist imperial wounds. And equally, demonstrations in London this past weekend. There was meant to be a Black Lives Matter protest, and it was called off at the last minute because the extreme right came out instead. And we're, as you might imagine, with guts flaring and faces red with alcohol and other narcotics, they displayed themselves on the streets of London. So broadly speaking, that's kind of some of the things that have happened. It is an ongoing thing. So we might just start with some basic things. From what we know, from what we're paying attention to, how do we think this thing is progressing? Does it look like it's going to keep the momentum it already has, or do you think it's going to kind of, a bit like Occupy, it's going to start becoming the, what's it called, the Lord of the Flies? So who wants to put their hand up? Ah, Scottish bums, which is James.
Yeah, I think broadly it's been pretty good. There's been more that's happened in about 2 weeks of protest than 8 years of, signing petitions. What you need is for people to have moments that give them revolutionary tactics and moments. So if you want to push things forward, not everyone can just get it from reading. Sometimes, because there's such a large propaganda machine that works against us. Sometimes it just needs to be something along the lines of an interaction with the police where the less than pleasant can revolutionize someone, or, they're on strike for a good reason and the police beat them up. That's how many, say, firefighters have become, involved in left-wing politics. And the police tactics very early on clearly worked against them in terms of public opinion. So there's little gains being made here and there, and that can be really important because that shows people that you can win, and then you can start building on top of that. There's some questions to be left about, say, okay, you defund the police, forcing the will of capitalism that way. Capitalism doesn't need the police to function. It's already got, sort of like inherent police systems in there. It's not afraid to crack a few heads or not. But, in places they're looking at defunding the police, and it probably won't turn out great, but it at least shows people that, look, if you kick off, if you do this, that, and the other, you'll start making the gains that you want to make. And so many people's response to just be like, oh, well, you know, you could have voted this all in.
Actually, what happened was the police retreated because
their arses in
they realized, firstly, they were overwhelmed, yeah. And secondly, not they did not well. Have, like, yeah, so the social like, capital to be able to, like,
I think I really liked what James was talking about.
So they withdrew.
Signposting for revolution.
Something I found
potential.
Interesting was the Chaz and now Chop, I suppose.
Chop people,
like,
has,
other people like that were,
so, like, the main,
obviously, initially. I suppose, like, agitators or, like, officials in the area, officials is a weird word, they started, like, responding quite weirdly. So, like, Donald Trump called the people in Capitol Hill ugly anarchists, I think he'd said. And then, like, everyone there started saying, oh, we're not anarchists. And I found that really interesting. And I found it interesting because when you look at their tactics, they're horizontally organized, they're, like, collectively managed. They've asked for things like rent controls. They've asked for things like the reversal of gentrification. They have demanded the abolition or at least defunding of police. And they started like community health funds and things like that. Apparently, they've also started asking for prisoners to be released if they're serving like, what's it called? Mandatory minimum sentences for marijuana related crimes. So like, I find it odd that they are so resistant to using the anarchist label, I just kind of find this bizarre, and I wasn't sure like why they did this when it seemed to be the case that so many of their positive the positive changes that they were making seemed to be anarchist inspired.
Well, just to correct a few, just one thing there. You were saying that the police were just abandoned because they were abandoned the 13th precinct because they were outnumbered. That's not strictly speaking what happened. There was on one of the protests about 60,000 individuals there. There was fight. The police kind of were using tear gas, rubber bullets, etc., and violent tactics as they've been doing.
Classic.
For weeks now. I think it was the mayor, more so than the governor, basically told them to stop doing that. And for like a day they did. But then they started using it again, and he basically pulled them back because of the violence they were displaying. They are now saying, the mayor is now, of Seattle is now saying that area has always been autonomous. It's always done its own thing. That's the basic, you know, thing. And at the moment, well, we'll get into this in a bit, but at the moment there is kind of a negotiations ongoing between CHOP and the mayoral office about basically letting the police back into the area, so which obviously the organizers don't want to. Sure. That's where things currently are. Now, I want to go to Oisin, so he can give his opinions, basically to reassure mm-hmm. the question. How have the Black Lives Matter protests evolved since we last discussed them 2 weeks ago? Obviously, we gave a little introduction there a second ago, but in your own opinion, Oisin, how do you think they've evolved?
Well, I think they have started to take inspiration from different camps insofar as they are sort of, you said they've adopted a horizontal structure of organization. And they've also started to give interviews to people, and you know, they're using some tactics from places like Barcelona, where, you know, they actually invited the press in, and just, you know, sort of invited them in and let them make up their own minds and stuff, you know. But I do think that, like, sort of Fox News and everything have the wrong, completely the wrong end of the stick.
What? And, shocking.
Yeah.
We should probably get straight to the point, really, which is the big thing. We've been talking a lot about it, but I mean, before we talk about Chaz, CHOP, what it is, what it isn't, good things, the bad things, the whatever things. A couple of other things that have happened since corporations, celebrities embracing Black Lives Matter, The Democratic Party has called for the tearing down of statues, Confederate leaders, which is interesting. They had never done that before openly, not to this level. Is there anything else that has gone on? Starbucks said they wouldn't let their staff wear Black Lives Matter, then completely U-turned and said, oh, no, that's, we've always been in favor of this. So could this be the moment, before we leave the general discussion of Black Lives Matter, could this be the moment that mainstream white America, and all the polling seems to suggest it's true, has embraced Black Lives Matter as a slogan? So I see James's hand is up.
So it's important to say that companies have people that are paid millions of dollars per year to make sure that companies are seen to be on the right side of history. So that is basically all it is. Like, Microsoft and Amazon are still making facial recognition software that is going to predominantly affect minorities more than it's going to affect white people. Amazon still pay poverty wages, and in America, you know, obviously you're more likely to be someone of an ethnic minority if you're going to be working there. It's a mouthpiece because polite society is telling them which way the wind is blowing, but it's not going to change anything substantial.
No, but I didn't mean that. I mean, is this a moment where basically this becomes a pillar of the kind of the Democratic Party, or maybe even beyond that, becomes basically something that you can't really say anything against? So for the comparison might be Me Too in 2017, 2018, when it was kind of this wave that began, well, in that case, it began online and then spread into out and from there. But this has kind of began in the streets and spread online. So is this, is there anything positive to be said for, at the very least, this the acceptance of police murder of African Americans has kind of, I don't want to say peaked, but basically it's not as acceptable as it would have been 3 or 4 weeks ago. That the kind of the Rubicon has been crossed in terms of doing this, of accepting this, and the ideas of defunding the police are now openly being discussed. I mean, a month ago, no one would have fucking said to Joe Biden, what about defunding the police? You know, I mean, that's a huge thing, whether we want to kind of scoff or not. It's a huge fucking thing to get even for them to talk about it. So, Oisin.
Yeah, so I think that it's very much generational. So our generation would be of the opinion that, you know, everything is up for debate, you know, we can talk about, you know, defunding the police, talk about the militarization of the police force in America, whereas our parents' generation would be still of the view of a very fixed mindset, you know, police keep us safe, you know, these are the only line between here and anarchy. And I think that's been proven to be a sham, you know. So I'm not saying that we have all the answers, but I think we have more of the answers on our side as young people.
Agreed. Will, not a cop, Will.
Yeah, so like, I think the thing when you were talking about the debate shifting quite radically, Alex, it reminded me of like this. I assume you guys know about the Overton window, which talks about the acceptable space of discourse in like mainstream political narrative. So the Overton window is normally in America set by like Fox News and to a lesser extent CNN, and it's been pretty like rightward facing. So like discussions about affirmative action or discussions about feminism are normally seen as being antagonistic principles. But over the past like 2 or 3 weeks, you're absolutely right. The fact that the rallying call of defunding the police is being mentioned in like fairly mainstream places, and actually, like you said, by Joe Biden himself, just shows how like far leftward the Overton window is facing. And like sometimes just getting these debates into the mainstream public consciousness is like such a massive move and such a like an enormous step towards positive change. And we really, I don't think we can like just discount these discussions. I think they are really important. I think I agree.
James, hands up.
Yeah, I think it's important to remember, though, that we've been here quite a few times before, where you've got the zeitgeist that is effectively saying this is how we're going to, how we should move forward. And Capital is very good at making itself seem like it's doing what it should be doing, but is still doing the opposite. And this is, unsurprisingly, galvanized the far right to take to the streets as well.
True. So, Nashikop, Will, just a brief response before we move on.
Yeah, I just wanted to really quickly say that I'm surprised James is so cynical about this. I mean, like, next he'd be telling me that the Live Aid concert didn't make a difference, and that Bono's Project Red credit card didn't make a difference. I mean, come on, like, this is
you leave Bob Geldof out of
it. Yeah, leave him alone.
So we'll get to the most important subject matter of the what I think is the most important subject matter, which is the issue of Chaz/Chop. Is it anarchist run? Could it be described in any way as anarchist or communally run? Is it just a repeat of Occupy? What do we think it is? A lot of heavy questions there. It could be said that Will mentioned earlier that it is communally run along consensus lines. I watched the video. It looked pretty similar, a bit more upmarket, to be honest with you, to the Occupy protests I was involved in Edinburgh way back in 2011 and 2012. Very much more upmarket. less at the moment anyway, it's less Lord of the Flies and more kind of Burning Man. But it seems to be that, you know, at least initially, the idea of having barricades, manning them, keeping the police out, making demands about completely abolishing the police, releasing prisoners held for marijuana, and I think resisting arrest. I mean, there's a lot of really positive things coming out of it. As Will said earlier, they have denied, or at least some of them have denied, they're anarchists. Again, presumably because they know most people don't really know what the word means. Probably safer to just not use the word, I think they're probably thinking. But what do we think of it, and what do we think it is? Oisin?
Yeah, so I think, you know, they have certain hallmarks of anarchists, but I think there's a lot of reluctance within the movement to actually call themselves that. And I also think that, you know, Fox News and certain white celebrities have been very effective in sort of galvanizing sort of arguments against CHOP. So you see sort of these white advocates coming out on Instagram and stuff and being like, this is absolutely fantastic. And, you know, I just want to say, it's so good that it's non-violent, and you're sort of thinking like, what are key bono, like, you know, so who benefits from you saying that? And it's obviously white people. So I think there is a certain there has to be a certain self-reflectivity on the part of the Seattle protesters to say, no, actually, we're not going to be placated by white people posting Instagram photos of BLM or whatever, you know, a black tile. But with regards whether it can be considered an anarchist, I think there are elements of it that are anarchist, but I don't think there's enough class consciousness among the protesters as a unit. Yes.
So before we get to James, it should be said that they changed the name from Chaz to Chop.
Yeah.
The activists, Black Lives Matter activists, said that there wasn't enough focus on activism, and they wanted to refocus the group more on that and less on being like a Skillshare thing. So, James.
Yeah, well, that kind of leads into my point nicely, because it's just one of those things that there's lots of conflicting information coming out from, and it is hard to get a handle on. Now, part of that is coming from people that are purposely trying to seed disinformation. People like Paul Joseph Watson, who is like, he did a tweet today saying like, it's called CHOP because of guillotines. Yeah, exactly. If it was, then, you know, like, but he's an idiot. He doesn't realize that how much support that would give it. But I think from what I can tell, the change from Chaz to Chop is actually a bad sign, because lots of people are coming out and saying like, oh, we changed it because of what Fox News was saying, and that we're like, we were trying to succeed from the American soil, which one, like white protesters in America try and do that all the time in an armed manner. I mean, how many times over the past 2-3 years have they gone down with guns, libertarians, you know, to City Hall saying like, oh, you know, we're setting up this area, which is now, you know, not part of American soil.
Four years ago, they occupied a postal or a ranger's depot in the west of Washington State. So in the same state as Seattle now, they were heavily armed and they just left them alone. They didn't go anywhere near them.
Exactly.
And so then they got bored and they walked away eventually. You know?
But also, but my understanding that Chaz, at first, the name come from, would have been using theories from the Temporary Autonomous Zone book by Haakon Bay, which is, you know, it's a fairly influential book in anarchist theory, which basically says, look, you know, certain situations, you can set up a zone that is going to be an anarchist zone. It doesn't last very long for a couple of reasons, but mostly because people will want to co-opt that zone and make it something that's permanent. But in this moment, you have like a brief bit of freedom, and then that will galvanize, you know, those people that happen, and it will change their life. Paris Commune is a good example of that. It changed a lot of people's life for the worse because of the injuries they suffered when the state came in, et cetera, et cetera. But you hear about them from time to time. You know, there, I can't remember what it was called, but, you know, in New York, there was a Taz zone that lots of, you know, late wave punk bands came out of, and that it spread a lot of revolutionary politics, and that was eventually co-opted by the New York Council, whatever you call them in America, and, you know, made part of the fabric of the city. But at those moments, you have those, it's like genuine freedom, and you can only have it for a little bit, and that's why it's a temporary autonomous zone. And so when it was called Chaz, I was like, oh, that's what they're doing. They're basing it on that theory, and that makes sense. But it just seems that it was called that by coincidence, effectively.
My worry with it is, from what I've read and from what I've seen on video, is it does bear a striking resemblance, as I said earlier, an upmarket version of Occupy, which I had a lot of experience with, and a lot of the same things are there, a lot of the same kind of well-meaning naivete about, you know, the police being out of there. So again, with the Occupy movement in Edinburgh, I think it was Georgia Square, I can't remember which it was. It was the one, I think it was Georgia Square. And the cops just stayed out because they thought, okay, well, they'll be gone soon. And eventually they weren't. And there's still debate about how much they infiltrated it and ripped it apart, or whether it was just our own stupidity. It could be anything. But it certainly didn't help. It was in the midst of the winter. So hopefully the summer might help them somewhat. But other issues are still there, which is that as long as you just stay there, the zone kind of becomes the reason why you're there. The relationships are important and they're great. It gives a good opportunity to educate, but it also kind of anchors you to that one spot, and it becomes the thing you have to defend, and more than, you know, defend the actual zone, defend the actual reason for being there. And organizing starts to stall in many ways. So I found by the end of my experience with Occupy that I was like, I don't think this is a good idea to repeat this unless it was like it's just merely the beginning of a kind of a revolutionary moment. And some of the people in Chaz have said that, look, if unless we're just repeating this around Seattle or around America, it's going to just, as James said, be co-opted. It's eventually going to become, the people who defend it will be defending it like the people in Christiania in Copenhagen defended it to the very end, even though by the end it was certainly not an autonomous zone. It had become one of the more conservative places in Copenhagen, and rents had gone to, you know, all these sorts of things. But the only thing you could do in Christiania was smoke weed by the end. So that would be my worry. Yeah, my worry would be that unless there's momentum with it, and I don't mean necessarily UK Labour momentum, but like there's less, this is merely just a stepping stone to something else. I would worry that it'll just get bogged down like the Occupy movement did in navel gazing and in just endless internal disagreements, renamings. That's what my worry would be. And I think Black Lives Matter know that there's a potential with that, and that's why they want to keep things moving. And that would be my worry. James?
Yeah. So it is, like, where's their manifesto? I'm not saying like they need one, but that's the sort of, you need to be doing things that give you a sense of community and purpose. We're not there, so it is hard to get a sense of what it's like. But, you know, if you get a manifesto together by a committee and then put it out, and or you say like this is what we're planning to do and why we're doing it, then you're going to have quite a lot of cohesion quite quickly in that sense. Where, I mean, again, it's always like things that get cherry picked, but there is a video on Vice that you can go watch on YouTube. And someone saying, like, you know, they're talking about the autonomous zone and, you know, they're calling it Chaz. And then someone comes up and interrupts the...
It's Chop, yeah.
It's actually, I think you'll find it's called Chop now. And it's like, it's unbelievably rude to just, like, while someone's doing an interview to camera to break into it. But it comes from a sort of, like, tone policing thing. Where it's like, well, actually, I think you'll find that I'm the one that's in the right here, so I'm going to stop what you're doing to just tell you that, like, dude, like, you're out of order.
That sounds like something from High Fidelity.
No, it sounds like the
Ennio Morricone's greatest album is the soundtrack from The Mission. It's just tasty. So, I mean, that is a worrying sign. It suggests a type of... as you were saying, kind of not thought police, but the type of thing which is just like correcting people's grammar online, which is kind of like a type of fucking stupid trolling, or being one of those people in class who goes, you know, it was actually Malatesta, not, you know, Bakunin that said that, duh, which is a worrying thing. But I mean, it's still early days.
It actually sounds more like The Life of Brian. It's like, we're not the Judean People's Front. Fuck you. We're the People's Front of Judea, you know?
Good point. So what we might do is just have, it's obviously too early to tell where it's going to go. I'd say for people who are listening, keep an eye on it. I think keep a critical eye and see, because again, as of right now, they're negotiating with the city. They've allowed the cars travel through the area again. They've opened up barricades for that. Doesn't bode well that they're doing that already, but we're not there, as we said, so we can't judge them, or we don't know, have enough information probably about what exactly is going on. But we probably, before we move on from this particular topic, what do we think of the idea of trying, of people in the States or over here even trying to mimic that, much like the Occupy movement of almost 10 years ago now? It began in America, but spread throughout large parts of the world, into Dublin, into Edinburgh, to London. Do we think that it would be a good idea if such an autonomous zone was set up in Dublin or wherever Will might be? Who knows? Because we can't say his surname or where he's working. But you know, but it rhymes with... but do we think it'd be a good idea to have autonomous zones here or try to do that? Will, not a cop, even though you came in second, you haven't talked in a while.
Oh, that's really nice of you. So I live in Southampton. it's not so secret. In fact, you can probably hear the seagulls in the background of this recording. They're constant here. It's ridiculous. Yeah, I mean, like, I suppose, like, perhaps naively, I'd say that these things are worth trialing constantly everywhere. If nothing else, they, like, disrupt the status quo quite a lot. And I think, like, they do, even when they fail, they do show people what an alternative looks like, and each time we fail, we might learn something, and we might get better gradually.
James?
Yeah, I mean, that was pretty much what I was going to say. Zizek calls it the idiot's revolution.
That's funny, because Zizek is himself an idiot.
but yeah, it's the theory that, like, you just need to keep failing, and you learn each time that you fail through history. You know, as you say, like, the signs are not good for Chaz slash Chop for various different reasons. But it might have been the time that it did work. So you don't know until it's happening. So it's worth doing it for the sake of doing it to just see if maybe this time it's the one that's going to succeed, because, you know, you've got the history there. You can, if you've been involved with it before, you know why it doesn't work. Like, revolutionary politics is effectively, you know, playing Dark Souls. It's you being fired out of a cannon at a wall endlessly, time and time again. But eventually, if you can fire yourself at the wall enough times, the wall will actually fall.
Mate, what version of Dark Souls have you been playing?
Any of them. It's so hard.
Might just say that before I go to Oshin, there is actually something in my head that's probably the most nerdy thing, which is there's an episode of Doctor Who where Doctor Who gets trapped in something, and he has, and every time he's being chased by this creature that kills him at the end of every whatever amount of days, and he learns that there's this big thick wall of like fucking pure diamond, and he starts punching it, and he punches it for like 6 billion years in time, but each time like he dies, he's punched a bit more on it. So it could be a bit like that, except horribly nerdy and anoraki, and no one look at me right now.
This is worse than Pokemon.
Yeah, exactly. Actually,
that is violent. You've just committed, Alex.
I don't have anything to say after that. I mean, really. Wow. But I think there is a
Can I just say before you go on there that it was actually Peter Capaldi, Doctor Who? So that does give me a bit of.
Oh, well, that's then, it's completely fine then, Alex. Sorry.
That's better.
So, yeah, I do think that there is a certain element of ever tried, ever failed, you know, try again, fail better. So, but I think it would be too early to really have a view on that, because we don't know enough about their manifesto. Like, they don't have a manifesto. They just say defund the police force. And then some of them are calling for further measures to be taken. So I think it is a good step in the right direction, but of course there's myriad factors that can sort of delegitimize it. Or, you know, I saw on Fox News they were talking about the criminal records of some of the key protesters, and I was like, that is such a fucking bullshit. Like, I mean, when have you ever heard of a protester being a fucking convict? Like, you know, that never happened in the United States, defending the United States, like, you know. So yeah, I think time will tell. Time will sort of show it in a new light.
Okay, so what we'll do is we'll move on a bit, but it's the same topic, it's just slightly different, which is something that has happened almost across the States, and has, as we said earlier, happened now in London, in Bristol, London to some degree, Belgium, you name it. Not happened here in Ireland for reasons we'll get to in a bit. The felling of statues, the call for the removal of statues. We said earlier on in the episode that statues of Leopold II, of Edward Colston, I think his name is pronounced, calls for the removal of Churchill, of Baden-Powell. In Ireland, there's been a very small call for the removal of a statue of an Irish Republican called John Mitchell, who, after he was exiled from Ireland in the 1840s or 50s, he ended up in America, where, bizarrely, he decided, you know what, after fighting oppression, I'm going to join the Confederacy. Which seems a strange thing to do, but there you go. And there's a statue of him in Armagh, and there's calls to take that down. There's a statue of a guy in Fairview Park near a certain... Oshin.
It was actually that he was a Nazi collaborator.
Yeah,
the one in Fairview Park.
Yeah. So there's a couple of things in Ireland, but they haven't quite reached fever pitch, and there's no demonstrations about it. Though a few people have cut off Sean Russell's head over the years. But basically, what is the origin of the controversies over statues in America? How is it spread to Europe? Does anyone want to throw their hat in and give an explanation for this? I can do my own if you don't want to do that. Oh, not a cop. Well, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I can do a wee bit, I suppose. So, like, I should say, in the school at which I currently work, I have this class that are not curriculum-based. So the school told me, you've got this class, you don't have to teach them anything particularly, but we want you to teach them, like, critical thinking skills, and we want you to teach them, like, logic and things like that, and we want to see, most importantly, if this raises their results in other classes. So I thought, okay, since the lockdowns happened, we've not done that much with them. And the other night, on a bit of a whim, I emailed the class two articles. One was from The Spectator, like perhaps the worst magazine in the world. And the other one was from Novara. And the article from The Spectator was saying that statues shouldn't be toppled because they are a celebration of our country's morally ambiguous and morally compromised past. And even though that past may be unpalatable, it's worth remembering. The Novara article was obviously the exact opposite and said that we shouldn't be venerating slavers and things. So the class went and did their own research, and most of them, I'd say about 80% of this class, came back with this argument that was remarkably similar to the dominant Black Lives Matter argument that had been put forth in America and then in the UK, which was something like, if you're a Black person walking around and you're seeing statues of your oppressors all over the place, you might justifiably think that the environment and the social structures are hostile to you, personally hostile to you. As a consequence of this, they ought to be taken down. This is basically the same argument that Black Lives Matter people were doing. They were saying, look, these statues are things you put up to celebrate people. If we as a society are saying that these slavers ought to be celebrated, this is like an obviously hostile and aggressive thing to say to people in our community. Our community can't flourish under such material conditions. So either we flourish as a community and take these statues down, or you acknowledge that you don't want us to flourish as a community and keep these statues standing. Most groups in the UK, most people I think, are actually pretty sympathetic to the view that we should be tearing these statues down now. I certainly think in America that must have traction as well. But yeah, I was interested to find out my kids, who are predominantly speaking economically impoverished, emotionally depressed a lot of the time, kids in this like bullshit town in bullshit town in Hampshire, were like on the side of like Black people they'd never met, and that was really amazing for me to like to learn this.
Before we go to James, just say very briefly, what Will said, most of the calls for the statues to be torn down in America are because they're actual Confederate generals or people who own slaves. A bit more contentious people like Jefferson, some of his statues have been torn down. He owned 600 slaves. He also may or may not have fathered like 11 kids with one of his slaves. So a very unpleasant person. But at the very least, the statues of Robert E. Lee, of Jefferson Davis, who actively fought, killed, in the case of people like the founder of the Ku Klux Klan, his name escapes me, but he there was a statue of him, I think, in Nashville in Tennessee. And he had, during a very notable massacre in Georgia, had surrounded a fort that the Union had taken. It was only...
Nathan Bedford Forrest,
pardon me, I forgot his name. But he surrounded the fort, it surrendered, and they slaughtered everybody inside, of course, being Black soldiers who were in the Union side. And he then founded the Ku Klux Klan. That's the big thing in the States, to take down those statues in particular. And the resistance from that, the arrival of armed militia to defend basically what is a colonial racist state. So that's kind of the American side of things. James.
Yeah, so the tearing down of the statue in Bristol was a genuine moment of praxis, effectively. And the amount of petitions and hard work that's gone in to try and take that statue down, Now, I'm not a major like knowledge when it comes to Colston, but I do know that, you know, Bristol has a specific history with him. There's secret societies in Bristol that are sort of evolved around him. And people have been trying to get rid of that statue. And so it was just one of those moments where, you know, like either, you know, someone was premeditated enough or there was just enough lying around to make it happen. It kind of doesn't matter which one it was, but the statue went down. And it was just a moment of doing what polite society was refusing to do. You know, the amount of like signing petitions that people were doing and, you know, going on Radio 4 and talking about it, et cetera, wasn't getting it done for various reasons. So just fucking tear it down yourself, hoof it into the river, and that'll be the end of it. And what's happened is that genuine moment of maybe like pure joy, of collective joy. Obviously, we would say, like, when you work in the media, there's certain ideas that you don't want people to have because it's a good idea, and you don't want that spreading. And so that's why you try and stop certain things getting into the news, because that might give people a good idea to do it themselves. But, you know, now in this age, it's a lot harder to stop that from happening when everyone's got a camera phone. So it's taken off, and then people are going off and tearing down other statues they don't like. But what's happened is very quickly gone from that moment to culture war bullshit, where it's a really handy thing to distract people with by saying, oh, look, they want to tear down this statue of J.M. Barrie and Kerrymuir, let's say, for instance. Now, he was probably highly a nonce, but he's not someone that, like, the average person today has a lot of hate about. And there's not even a statue of him. It's of Peter Pan and Kerrymuir. But you will find now that there's people go, like, any statue in the city centre, they'll just go out and they'll stand in front of it and keep watch in case people tearing it down. And it's because the way that the narrative has been sold to people, rather than it being a revolutionary moment of like, fuck that guy, fuck his politics and everything he stood for, it's now just like they think that people are just tearing down statues because they're there. And so they're standing in front of statues of people that don't matter, have no interest. You know, and some people were saying, like, oh, why aren't we tearing down statues in Ireland? Maybe that's got some good questions. But also, there's statues of Jim Larkin in Ireland. So, you know, and he's one of the good guys. He's one of the people that you actually want a statue of.
It should be said, just as a brief historical point, that between the 1920s and about the, at most the 60s, but mostly the 40s, we either tore down or blew up most of the statues of British imperial figures. So we don't have any of those left. I think we saw the last one was blown up by the IRA in 1966, I think it was, which was on O'Connell Street, which was of Horatio Nelson. Yeah. So now that doesn't mean we don't have figures. It's Ireland's weird because we didn't put up statues to Eamon de Valera, which you might imagine would have been torn down by now. We didn't put up ones of John Charles McQuaid, who was a really nasty piece of shit. So because that definitely would have been torn down by now. It's weird. Ireland has a weird relationship with statues, probably because the British put so many up. There was almost like there's no statues of any of the 1916 leaders other than, well, there's one of James Connolly, but that's it. And it's not connected to the state. It's connected to the trade union he was a member of. So there's a very weird relationship with Ireland and the statues, which maybe we could go into at another time. But in terms of Colston, he personally was responsible for transportation of 90,000 slaves, of which 19,000 died in the passage from West Africa to America. He made his fortune off it. But the interesting thing is he died in the 1720s. It was in 1895 they put the statue up. So there could be, in the same way that with the Confederacy, most of the generals were dead before they put up most of the statues in the 1920s. So the statues are not actually about the people themselves. They're about the cultural moment there that in which the statues are put up. So in the 1890s, height of empire, the 1920s, the beginning of the rollback of, a very, very beginning of the rollback of Jim Crow, because the Ku Klux Klan are their height then, but it's beginning to kind of emerge then. So in regards to statues, I, you know, for all the complexity of it, there is something to be said as a kind of as a deed to tear them down. Certainly of figures like Leopold II, who is a genocidal figure. I mean, I can't go on enough about a great book by Adam, I think it's Adam Hochschild. It's called King Leopold's Ghost. It's one of the most disturbing books you will ever read. You could also read In the Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad to learn some of the horrors that were in Congo. So, I mean, those are things which I think are just self-evident. The fight back against it is interesting because it's often these guys who, like Tommy Robinson, like what the fuck does Tommy Robinson have to be gained from defending Churchill's statue or defending Baden-Powell or defending any of these fucking people who they never met, they never knew, they don't even know very much about. Not a cop will.
Yeah, like Tommy Robinson's a really weird one. So he was one of the architects of the counter protest that happened on, I think, Saturday, was it?
Yeah.
Like last Saturday. Yeah. But he himself wasn't allowed to go because he's got various bail conditions. Which he has to satisfy, or like not bail conditions, parole conditions maybe, because you know he's like literally a convicted prick. I think that's like the official charge. Tommy Robinson, you are hereby guilty of being a prick. But yeah, like it's really weird. So like the Britain First, Nazis, the EDL fascists that all turn up, started defending the Winston Churchill statue. I really don't like Churchill at all, but he clearly wasn't a fascist. Not that type of fascist anyway. And the fact that you had a bunch of neo-Nazis going and defending a statue of Churchill, and then one of them was taking a piss on a memorial dedicated to a policeman who was killed trying to stop a terrorist or something. Like, who the fuck are these people? Like, their politics are so incoherent. Not even incoherent, with a broader political understanding. They're incoherent with their own terms. I just do not get it at all.
Well, James could probably talk about this because she knows a lot about both these subjects. Ash Shakar, Sarkar, I can't pronounce her surname, pardon me, was on, I think, Radio 4. And she was just pointing out the ridiculousness of taking an episode of Fawlty Towers off, I think, UK television or some online streaming service. Anyway.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And then Cleese himself responded and said, political correctness gone mad. What is it, just going down a rabbit hole of the culture wars, of this type of kind of wokeness, to take episodes of things off the TV and where there's blackface or where Basil Fawlty's being a racist or being a sexist, or is that just a bad road to go down because it's just going to piss people off that don't need to be pissed off, or is there something to be said for that? James?
Sorry. James? Yeah. No, it's just culture war bullshit because there's this idea that, say, the woke left are these snowflakes and babies and they can't stop shitting their pants about everything. But that's always projection from the right. There is no sensible person that would say, look at Fawlty Towers and go, look, it's got problematic stuff in it. There's no doubt about it. And that's because John Cleese himself is a problematic figure. But that doesn't stop it from being funny. There's a difference between doing blackface and it being purposely there to offend people, or like in the way that, you know, it was done in the black and white minstrel show, to like, what, I don't even know what the black and white minstrel show was and why it had blackface, to be honest, and say the way that Sarah Silverman does it or did it, I should say, in that one episode, or It's Always Sunny did it. And it's not our place as white people to say, like, when you can and can't do blackface. And so there's definitely a conversation there to have, like, right, you know, probably maybe you shouldn't do it at all because it's, you're too likely to offend people. But I don't think there's anyone in Black Lives Matter that is going around saying like, oh, we should just ban It's Always Sunny because they did blackface once, or we should ban Sarah Silverman for a blackface episode. And it's just stoking the flames of the idea that it's just reactionary, and there's a motive thing to get people's blood up, and so you can then stop people from noticing what the protests are actually about, from something that is complicated and has a lot of political ramifications into, oh, they can easily be ignored because they don't like the Mighty Boosh now because, you know, the Spirit of Jazz has black makeup on.
Yeah. Will, what do you think?
Yeah, so like, I like totally agree with what James just said. I am the world's biggest fan of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Like, I cannot, like, I watched this from episode one, series one, through to like series 14 on repeat, and I have done for about 2 years now. Just like watch it literally every day, like watch loads of episodes. It's like a total obsession. And I think there are like maybe 5 blackface episodes. So like Dee has like, she does like these characters, and one of them is like Martina Martinez, and it's just like a racial caricature of like a, I think, an Hispanic person of some sort. I don't know, like, I don't know if it's specified. Then there's the Lethal Weapon show that films they make, in which like they alternate who the Danny Glover character is portrayed by. So like these things were taken down, and Netflix got a wave of complaints about the taking down of It's Always Sunny. And when Netflix did the analysis of who was making the complaints, it turned out it was members of the black community themselves who'd complained about it. Firstly, because taking down the episodes of It's Always Sunny became the news story, where it shouldn't, like as James said, it was just culture war bullshit. It shouldn't have become the news story. It was a massive distraction. And the whole point of the It's Always Sunny episodes was that there is no good faith way to do blackface without being racist. So even though Dee is like, she wouldn't identify her character, Martina Martinez, as like a racial caricature, she's doing it because she thinks it's funny, quote, I'm not racist, but the whole point of those episodes are like, it's not okay for them to determine the terms under which it's acceptable to do blackface ever. And it is just distracting culture war nonsense. So yeah, like totally agree with what James had said. And also, everyone should watch It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. It's the best thing in the world.
Back to James.
Yeah, I mean, again, it is complicated. Like, the thing is with comedy is you're always trying to look for where the line is and not cross it, and you try and push towards it. And you usually end up crossing it once in a while, especially if you're something like South Park or It's Always Sunny, where you're bumping up against that line almost constantly. In some ways, I do think that, as I said earlier, though, it's like, it's not our place to decide if it's okay to do blackface or not in a situation thing. And it was like the other day, Harry Enfield was on Radio 4 saying, you know, I've played every prime minister, you know, I've done an impression of them since I've done my career as a comedian. And so you're saying to me, if there's a black prime minister, I won't be allowed to do an impression of them. And it's just such a weird tone deaf thing to say, because it's like, well, yeah, don't do blackface. Like, it's not that hard to do, or not do, more succinctly. Like, there's no one saying that you can't do an impression of, you know, hopefully one day a black prime minister, but either don't do it in blackface, or get, you know, someone that can do it. Get, you know, someone that is of African descent to do the impression rather than you do it. It's not difficult. There's plenty of black comedians working and operating in the UK.
So one last thing before we wrap up the episode. So all of this comes to the point of racism in society in Britain and Ireland. I suppose we'll go to Oisin about Ireland, but maybe we should probably do that first, since we've talked a lot about the UK, and we'll come back to that in a second. But Oisin, do you think that there are, well, we don't really have the statue issue, but are there other metaphorical statues, metaphorical things? For example, Eamon Ryan in the Dáil or so used the N-word repeatedly.
And yeah.
He's still the leader of his party, has kind of gave a half-assed apology saying, oh, I was just trying to get prove a point, being tone deaf. There are no black people in the Irish Parliament. Do we think there are metaphorical statues in Ireland of racism or connected to
these? Absolutely, absolutely. Without a shadow of a doubt. I mean, and people are always quoting the commitments, like, you know, the Irish are the blacks of Europe and Dublin are the blacks of Dublin or Ireland and the North Dubliners are the blacks of Dublin. Fuck that. Like, I mean, you know, we're in a very privileged situation here, and we don't really know what it's like to be, you know, properly enslaved in the way that black Americans forefathers were. So I think we love to sort of push this narrative that we can't be racist. We were colonized by the British, you know. And I think that's a very useful stick to beat the British over. But in fairness, we were involved in the civil service in India. We have a lot of sort of dark periods of time where, you know, we, for instance, sent a letter of condolence to Hitler or to the German people on Hitler's suicide. I think there is certainly an undercurrent of racism. Like, you know, my granny, on finding out that my cousin was going out with a black guy, said, well, she's no granddaughter of mine. Like, you know, so I think all of this stuff has to be looked at more closely and scrutinized more effectively if we are to make a change in this country.
Well, at the moment it's not scrutinized at all, so any amount of scrutiny would be good. James.
Alex, just say what you said there again, because you broke up when you said that.
Oh, I said that there's zero level of scrutiny as it is right now, so any level of scrutiny would be good.
Good. When I first moved to Ireland about 4 years ago, the amount of people that said to me, as a point of pride, we don't have racism here like you do in the UK. And then quickly finding out how the Irish traveller community is talked about and discussed in Ireland, like, completely blew my mind. There's this idea that, I mean, listen, I've lived in a few places, and even when you go to England, you can tell it's a less nice place to live for various reasons. And you can just tell it in Scotland, like, you know, by walking around the city. And, like, Ireland tends to be a less aggro place to live overall. But that doesn't mean that it's free from systemic racism. The fact that, you know, a direct provision is allowed to happen in Ireland is amazing. It's completely confounding to me that happens, and then someone can say to me, oh yeah, but we don't have racism over here. Or, I've lost my thought thread there. It was to do with direct provision.
Basically, racism in Ireland, it's very, very much present. It's just the Irish, for some reason, like to pretend that events that happened over 100 years ago somehow mitigate or kind of obfuscate that, which I think is true. I think the Irish are kind of maybe not deluded, but they think they have a very out-of-date opinion of where the line is, what's acceptable and what isn't, and even the use of words, racial slurs in regards to Chinese people to describe picking up some chips or something like that. That's a very common thing. And as Oisin said, the kind of casual racism is really there, and in a way that maybe would have been acceptable in a Jim Davidson's 1970s or early 1980s Britain, but it's not acceptable now. And we don't get away with it just because we're Irish. But in regards to our favorite punching bag to finish up, it's obviously race is a huge thing in the UK. I suppose we'll finish with, is there anything that can be taken from all the Black Lives Movement that is a positive in like in what's happening? Is this a turning point, hopefully in the UK at the very least, for whether it's just statues or language that can be used? Is it anything positive here, James?
Yeah, so I think the main thing, like, if anything, I think that will happen from this is basically from the 90s onwards, the idea of that, like, racism was just basically being impolite. And, you know, like, well, I can't be racist because I don't use the N-word. And that seems to be how a lot of people just set out the barn by saying, like I'm not, like, aggro towards, you know, bane people. I don't say, you know, bad things when I go to the corner shop. So I'm not racist. And hopefully from this, it'll be like, racism is not always about, you know, saying the N-word or something similar. It's actually systemic within culture. And if anything comes from this and it's just like that idea starts getting through to people, then in some ways, that's a win.
Absolutely. Last word for Will.
I think it's probably my turn to be a bit cynical now. I don't really see much long-term positive political change coming from this. Purely because, like, a thing I saw in the newspaper maybe a few days ago was about the Cecil Rhodes statue in Oxford being taken down. And this is the second time I've heard this debate now. And the first time, I think, was around about 2013, 2014 with the Rhodes Must Fall protest movement that happened, and like Dickhall happened then, and it was a big deal at the time. Like, I'd say perhaps more of a deal than the current statue toppling is, but like literally nothing happened. It just petered out, and save for like a few people who were like really active in it, everyone kind of forgot about it. It's kind of been brought up again, but like, yeah, I don't know. I think living in England now for exactly 1 week has just made me jaded and depressed, and I just can't like imagine a better future. Sorry, guys.
That's a perfect place to end.
For our listeners, if you could like the and subscribe to the podcast, share it with friends. If you've got any questions or want to for us to cover
topics for us to discuss or something,
You can. You can go to the Anime U website or on Facebook, send us messages that
way. Don't just share it with friends, share it with enemies as well.
Send it to Brendan O'Neill and just see his head explode.
Oh my God, that'd be amazing.
We should do an episode on Brendan O'Neill's forehead.
Five head,
sorry. That'd be amazing.